Can only idealism save us?
We have to become much more idealistic. For instance, if we want to solve what's been called the perfect storm of environmental problems we're facing, climate disruption, toxification of the entire planet, all kinds of problems with the agricultural system, the prospect now still again of nuclear war, big problems with plagues. If we're going to deal with these, first of all, we need everybody working on it. And so unless we can get together and cooperate to solve our problems, we're not going to solve them. So that's one very idealistic thing.
That's world-renowned scientist Paul Ehrlich. We talk with him about his new book, Hope on Earth. And forget mega mansions. The new thing is tiny houses.
I looked at my budget and I noticed that about half of my income was going to housing. And I said, okay, crazy question. How could I completely eliminate that line item? So I had no idea how I was going to do that. But I went out and I started searching. And eventually I came to tiny houses. And I realized that for about the cost of 1 to 2 years rent, I could own a home free and clear.
That's Ryan Mitchell. We talk with him about living light on the earth and carefree in a tiny home. His book is Tiny House Living. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Recent reports about environmental doom are coming one right after the other. Greenhouse gas emissions are higher than ever and increasing at a record pace. Half the bird species in North America could go extinct by century's end due to global warming. Despair seems inescapable. But a new book says we don't have the luxury of despair. Hope on Earth is a conversation between two scientists, Paul Ehrlich and Michael Charles Tobias. They say we need to kindle hope if we are to respond to the environmental catastrophes we face. While Ehrlich and Tobias differ in some of their approaches, they agree on the central issue that global warming and other environmental threats are, at their core, issues of ethics and morality. Paul Ehrlich is most notably the author of the hugely influential 1968 book, The Population Bomb. He's an entomologist and president of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. Michael Charles Tobias is a writer, ecologist, filmmaker, and animal rights activist. He's president of the Dancing Star Foundation, which works on biodiversity conservation and animal protection. I spoke with Paul Ehrlich about Hope on Earth in July of this year. Well, Paul Ehrlich, welcome to Writer's Voice. I'm so honored that you agreed to talk with us today because I have long been an admirer of yours. Way back when you first published The Population Bomb, I was a young woman, and I was quite impressed over the years with, in spite of the fact of many people saying that its predictions were not being borne out, it seemed to me that just sheer logic would tell one that they would eventually, and they have. You have done this amazing conversation in Hope on Earth with Michael Charles Tobias. It was just fascinating, on ethics and how to confront the crises that face us. Tell us, how did this conversation between the two of you come about?
Well, Michael and I have worked together over the years, and he came out to the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab, where I'm talking from now, to do some filming. He's a great filmmaker and has a wonderful foundation. And he said, why don't we just tape our conversation and maybe it will turn out to be interesting. So I said, what the hell, we're going to have the conversation. We might as well tape it. And so we did. And then we got a colleague here who I had a walk with this morning, John Hart, who's done a brilliant experiment on climate change here, maybe the most important, one of the most important ever. And he chimed in, and so we included him at the end, and we just discussed a lot of stuff that we always talk about, but that I think much of which the public never hears about. And so had a good time, and just have an edited transcript, which we reinforced a little as time has gone by. It was 2 years ago we did the actual taping.
Yes, and we'll get to that study, I think, a little later on. But first, I want to start with chickens, because they feature pretty prominently in this discussion in the first chapter or so. You got into a pretty testy exchange with Tobias over chickens. He's a vegan. You're not. Tell us about that, and what really was at stake in that disagreement?
Well, first of all, Michael and I and John are all used to having disagreements. That's what scientists do. So there was no. It may have been a little testy, but we were kidding around. First of all, I agree with Michael that we have to eat much less meat, since we have many too many people on the planet to allow to make it even possible for everybody to have the kind of meat-rich diet that Americans consume. That's A. B. I also agree with him that although nutritional science is hardly the scientific peak, one of the things that does come through quite consistently, that eating red meat is not good for your health. That is, a heavy diet of red meat is a bad idea. And since the ecological costs of producing red meat are very high, there's an ecological as well as a health reason for ignoring that. Your taste in food starts very early, and I really do enjoy eating meat, and I don't share with Michael quite the concern for the animals that are eaten that he does. I share the concern for the way the food industry operates and how a lot of the meat is produced, and Ann and I have very much reduced our consumption of red meat, and very careful about what fish we eat, because, of course, we're wrecking the oceans, and many of the fishes that appear on the market should not be consumed. But we had an interesting contrast. He was extremely worried about beak clipping in chicks. When they mass-raise chickens, the young chicks have their beaks clipped so they don't peck each other to death. And yet he was not concerned with circumcision, which is a primitive rite that kills about 100 Americans a year, infants, tortures tiny infants. And so at that point, we decided that we had a difference of opinion, and we left it at that.
And yet your argument does highlight some of the ethical conundrums that people face. I mean, it might be fair to say that your position is, if you can raise chickens humanely, which a lot of people are beginning to do now, there's nothing wrong in eating chickens, whereas his point is that it's wrong for us to eat other sentient animals. You may come at it from a health point of view, an ecological point of view. He comes at it from a moral and ethical point of view. Where do people get into a kind of thorny thicket?
We unfortunately are very bright apes, and we have only one way of determining what's ethical, and that, in fact, is, in a sense, what the whole book is about. In other words, as individuals to start out with, but we have to, in order to establish ethics, we have to discuss it with each other. That's why only human beings can have ethics, because only human beings have the language with syntax, which allows us to ask questions like, is it right to kill a chicken in order to eat it? And people can have very different ethical positions, as you can see, throughout our society. And so the discussion is necessary. I don't particularly like killing sentient beings, if you could possibly, or even non-sentient beings. I don't even like, you know, breaking a crystal or killing a butterfly, although I've had to kill a fair number of butterflies in my research. I'd much rather get around it. Maybe one of these days we will be able to produce something that tastes like chicken but doesn't involve killing any chickens. That's fine. But all of us face ethical dilemmas all the time, and sometimes do things that we consider are not as ethical as they might be. Drive our car too much, fly around the world too much, eat too much meat, and so on. So I'm not saying I necessarily differ entirely with Michael on whether or not it's ethical to eat a chicken. Maybe it isn't as ethical as I would like, but I end up eating chickens anyway. And I think all human beings face dilemmas where we think it would be better if we didn't do something or didn't have to do something, but we end up doing it anyway.
Well, one of those areas that you do mention in the book, and you have a discussion about, is green energy, which you know, the more we adopt renewable energy like solar and wind, we could arguably save many thousands of species. But sometimes these projects, wind projects and solar projects, are opposed by environmentalists because they may affect one species or, in the case of wind, birds. How should we think about weighing the saving of many versus the saving of a few?
Well, I think that's one of the main things that Michael and I discussed extensively, to not any great conclusion. My own view of it is that, particularly when you're faced with the problem, the few become very important. You know, if you run into, say you run into an injured eagle, and you can take it in and have the right permits and therefore can solve the problem of its broken wing and hold it until it can be returned to the wild, that's something that seems to me at one level to be very ethical to do. On the other hand, if you are, say, an activist, maybe the time and money you spend on the eagle could be spent in trying to educate people in the Tea Party and actually save not only eagles but lots of other animals. And so there aren't simple answers here. One of the things that bothers me is that in our media in general, we don't have a lot of discussion of ethics. When you look at the climate situation, how much should we do to save future generations horrendous problems with the climate, maybe even our own generation if we're young enough today? We're already seeing all kinds of horrendous problems with the climate. And that's actually an issue that even economists have looked at that's rarely discussed. That is, the question of what you should do is in part tied to what economists call discount rates. That is, how rich are future generations going to be? Some people would claim that future generations are going to be so rich that we can screw up the climate entirely and they'll have the resources to unscrew it when the time comes. Others claim that future generations are probably going to be poorer. I happen to agree with that, in which case it seems to me we have a very heavy ethical debt to pay here, that we should be doing all kinds of things to try and spare our children and grandchildren from droughts and particularly starvation as the climate system wrecks the agricultural system and so on. So these are tough questions, and they are to be discussed by society as a whole. They shouldn't be determined by just the opinion of, say, a relatively well-off old white male, but we don't have the discussion.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with scientist Paul Ehrlich about Hope on Earth. It's a published conversation between Ehrlich and ecologist Michael Charles Tobias. And that argument was one that it resonates with the wager that you made with Julian Simon back in 1980, I believe it was. Tell us, first of all, about that wager in your words. You'll probably do a much better job of it than I will.
Simon was a professor of mail order marketing, and he was claiming that everything was getting better environmentally, that he, for instance, claimed that the only limit to the amount of copper that people could have available to them was the weight of the universe, because science would let us turn anything we wanted into copper, and so on. And John Holdren, who's now President Obama's science advisor, and John Hart, who's one of the people in the book, a semi-author of the book, and I... He was claiming that he would like to make a bet on how things were going to get really better, and he wanted to bet on the prices of commodities, particularly metals. And we said that's not the right measure, but he kept claiming it and saying ecologists were chicken. And so finally, we made the bet on a bunch of metals. The economy collapsed in part, and the metals turned out to be cheaper at the end of the bet, at the end of 10 years. A couple of them did. I don't remember the details. And not more expensive. And so we ended up paying him, I think the three of us together paid him about $250. And he then claimed he'd bet again on anything at all. And because we had told him that was the wrong bet, that metals prices were not a measure of environmental quality. And so he challenged us to make a bet on any measure of environmental quality at all. And Steve Schneider, the late climatologist, top climatologist, and I took him up on it at $1,000 over, I think, 20 or so various things, like how much CO2 there would be in the atmosphere, how much forest would be left, what would happen to wetlands, and so on. And if he had lived, if he ran away from the bet, he said he didn't want to bet on those things, and then B, if he had bet, he would have lost many thousands of dollars. So it's sad that this one incident, somebody who was so ignorant he thought you could transform the entire universe into copper. He once also said that we have enough information in our minds and computers to keep the economy growing, keep this growth going for 7 billion years. And he couldn't do enough arithmetic to know that long before 7 billion years were going by at the growth rate of population that we had at that time, long before 7 billion years went by, there would be more people than there were elementary particles in the entire universe. In other words, he was totally ignorant of science, but he got a lot of attention, particularly from right-wing radio. It's same sort of thing as Lomborg, hired basically to make trouble and try and prevent us doing anything about our increasingly nasty environmental situation.
Lomborg?
Lomborg is a failed statistician from Denmark who is, somebody told me he made something like $700,000 last year, claiming that there's no big problem with the environment, that we're all wrong, and it all can be fixed easily.
Okay, so these are just great examples of what you were talking about. Simplistic thinking that's kind of pie in the sky, you know, Panglossian, everything's just cool, we're going to invent our way out of the problems that we have. It seems like there are a whole lot of chickens, I'm talking about chickens, that are coming...
Back to chickens, here we go.
...that are coming home to roost at this time. You say in the book, Paul Ehrlich, in this conversation, Hope on Earth, your conversation with Michael Charles Tobias, that Earth is reaching a tipping point. Things look pretty dire, but you also say the only thing that's truly practical is idealism. Explain
well,
that.
I think we have to become much more idealistic. For instance, if we want to solve what's been called, not by me originally, somebody else, the perfect storm of environmental problems we're facing, climate disruption, toxification of the entire planet, all kinds of problems with the agricultural system, the prospect now still again of nuclear war, big problems with plagues. If we're going to deal with these, first of all, we need everybody working on it, which means that we've got to try and improve the condition, first of all, of minorities and women, and second of all, of the people who are behind the eight ball, either in nations or in our own countries, economically. I mean, we're working now with an economic system that is the Hood Robin system. That is, we're stealing from the poor and giving to the rich. And so unless we can get together and cooperate to solve our problems, we're not going to solve them. So that's one very idealistic thing. A good example is anybody who doesn't have to take off their shoes in order to count up to 20 knows there are too many people on the planet and the growth rate is horrendous. How do you solve that? Well, one of the best ways is to give women rights everywhere. I mean full rights, equal to men, full opportunities, and so on. There's no nation in the world where women get the same benefits that men get. And yet we know empirically that the more women's situations are improved, the fewer children they want to have. The second thing we ought to do, of course, is see to it that every sexually active human being has access to modern birth control and backup abortion. If we did those two things, we might start the population slowly declining towards something that might be sustainable. And the other part of the equation, which is, again, idealistic, is that we have to face the fact that the economy can't grow in perpetuity, that consumption can't grow, that the rich already have enough. The whole idea of getting enough, not always trying to have this competitive consumption, is going to be very idealistic, but I'm afraid we're going to have to, both of those things have to be done. We have to control and reduce gradually the size of the population, and we have to deal with overconsumption by the rich while we're trying to improve the status and give more consumption to the people who need it, the maybe 2.5 to 3 billion people on this planet that do not have adequate diets. One of the things that we said in the population bomb was that the battle to feed all of humanity is over. That was 1968, and we've been attacked ever since. People said then, don't worry, we can give wonderful lives to even, there were 3.5 billion people then, they said we can give wonderful lives and complete diets to 5 billion people, no problem. Then they said 7 billion people, no problem. Now they say 10 billion people, no problem. And we've always said, you know, why don't you just do it for the people we have today, and then we can talk about how many more we can do it for, because every one of those things has turned out not to be true. There are more people hungry and micronutrient malnourished today than there were alive when I was born. That was about 2 billion people when I was born. And the number hungry today is higher than it was when the population bomb was written. And yet people are totally ignorant of that. And they keep saying, well, what a terrible mistake. Ehrlich said the battle to feed all of humanity was over.
In other words, what you're saying is that we need to solve the problem of inequality in order to solve the problem of survival.
Yeah, the idea that you could have, as some people have, that there can be a fortress America where we'll live the rich life, drive our cars, consume everything we possibly can while the rest of the world goes down the drain, just doesn't fit with the physical, biological, social ways the world works. You got to remember that nuclear weapons are available to many people besides Americans and Brits. And the whole idea that we can continue to step on other people, if you want to go really preposterous, we fought a war, as was admitted by our government, in Iraq in order to get control, keep control of oil in the Middle East. Now, everybody who's looked at the situation, every scientist who's looked at the situation, realizes we have to get off of the fossil fuel standard. We have to stop burning coal and oil. So attacking Iraq to get their oil was like attacking Iraq if they had cyanide to get their cyanide to eat if we were hungry. Absolutely insane. Everybody who had any sense knew what was going to happen in Iraq. We wasted huge resources to generate a sectarian war there. And insanely, we're now sending back troops, advisors, and aircraft to screw around once again in a place where we should have long. You want to stop terrorism? Stop trying to run the world. We have CENTCOM, which is our military apparatus to deal with Central Asia. I don't know whether Russia has AmeriCOM or not, but I doubt it. We have AFRICOM, which is designed to keep our empire going and keep the oil flowing from Africa. These things are totally transparent, but you wouldn't find out about them in the New York Times, I promise you.
You know, I want to go back to this point about, you know, giving everyone an adequate living. Because one of the thorny problems that has arisen over the whole issue of controlling carbon emissions and getting to a climate pact has been that developing countries like India and China are saying, well, U.S., we don't want mandatory controls. Well, they didn't say to the U.S. because the U.S. doesn't want mandatory controls either. But what they've said is no mandatory controls. We need to have a chance to develop. You, developed world, have already had your chance, and now you're trying to take it away from us. What's your response to that? What's our way out of that problem?
Well, there's some considerable justification to their point of view. The way out of that is really simple, and that is they don't have to get developed to a reasonable point. One we should be moving to, too, is to not go through the old Victorian Industrial Revolution, which was fired by coal, but go as rapidly as possible to using solar energy, to getting their populations smaller. What we need to do is countries like the United States have to move off our super-consuming lifestyle. We have to start reducing our population, and those countries have to start not doing more coal, but borrowing, cooperate to get the solar technologies in place that should have been in place a long time ago. And the problem is we have little time. It's a very difficult task. It means there are going to be a lot of oxes gored. But it certainly is possible if we have the kind of mobilization, say, that the United States went through in World War II. In other words, you can change all kinds of patterns very rapidly if you have the political will and are willing to do it. But we obviously don't have the political will to do it. But it's insane to drive development in countries like China and India heavily on coal. That's just nuts. It's nuts from their point of view, and it's nuts from our point of view. And remember, the planet doesn't give a damn who's adding the CO2 to the atmosphere. It gets everybody uniformly. Some people will suffer more than others, but it's going to be scattered all over the place. We're already suffering in the United States from climate change. Look at Sandy. And the idea that we should keep battling over who's got to do what, we should get together, cooperate at all, move in the same direction, and we can help the poor countries move in that direction.
And I was surprised on reading your book, Paul Ehrlich, Hope on Earth, the conversation that you had with Michael Charles Tobias, that the Chinese, you know, they have their contradictions too, and as they're certainly, you know, polluting their way to disaster, They've conceived of this notion of a world ecological civilization, a term that I just love and I think really encapsulates just exactly where we need to go.
I think there's huge potential in China, but they have huge, huge problems. They basically have a very rich country of 300 million people embedded in a gigantic poor country of 1.3 billion people. Their leadership at the top are far ahead of ours on environmental issues. They're so far ahead of our Congress, you could hardly believe it. However, they have other attributes that we don't like. And as you go down through their structure in their nation, through their counties and so on, there's still all kinds of problems because the country's so big, the leadership really cannot control lots of things. They've been trying for thousands of years to move water from the south, where it's relatively abundant, to the north, and so far have largely been failing. They've been buying land in Africa because they realize they're not going to be able to feed their population as climate change and population growth continue. So China is a place where we should be cooperating. The U.S. and China should come together to solve their problems and get off of the idea that they ought to have a confrontation over the resources of Central Asia, which are mostly fossil fuels and which shouldn't be burned.
Right. So you are involved with something called the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere. Tell us about that.
Well, go to mahb.stanford.edu, but it's a group that is trying to get together and get civil society to coordinate its efforts so that, for example, no matter what your, for instance, if your environmental concern is saving the eagles, that's great. Save the eagles, but on all your literature, point out that you'll never save the eagles if we keep the population growing and everybody always consuming more. In other words, we're trying to get there are huge numbers of organizations that are trying to do good things, but they're not coordinating their efforts, and they're allowing, for instance, in the U.S., a totally broken Congress to have ridiculous elections, to have stupid candidates. We have a broken government at a time when we need a great government in the United States, and we need to be discussing how to get the world to cooperate. Nation states have had it. It's not the final form of organization unless it's going to be the end of civilization. We're going to have to move forward so we can solve our global problems. And that's a huge challenge that nobody wants to discuss because they talk about, well, we can't have global government. Well, we could have said the same thing with 13 independent colonies that hated each other often, that they couldn't get together and make a United States, but they did.
You have been a prophetic voice before. You are a prophetic voice now. As you survey the landscape, how do you deal with this on an emotional level? Your book is called Hope on Earth. Do you still have hope?
I have hope because we've seen societies change very rapidly and very dramatic. Again, if you look at the mobilization of the United States after December 7th, 1941, you can see how rapidly a society can change when it realizes its threat. When you look at, for instance, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 and the retreat of communism, none of the people in Congress that I knew or the political scientists have predicted that. They didn't expect it, but it happened. When the time is ripe, our societies can change dramatically. As we've been talking about, we need a really, really dramatic set of changes, and it is possible we'll get them. And it's when the time is ripe, and as I've said to many people, our job, those of us who are concerned, is to do everything we can to ripen the time.
Paul Ehrlich, you're new book, Hope on Earth, a conversation with Michael Charles Tobias, as well as with John Hart, is just a fascinating read. And this has been a fascinating conversation, too. Thank you so much.
Oh, I've enjoyed it. It's been great.
Paul Ehrlich is the author of many books, including The Population Bomb. Hope on Earth, a conversation, is out from the University of Chicago Press. And you can kindle hope by participating in the People's Climate March in New York City on September 21st. It's expected to be the largest climate action event in history. Next up, Ryan Mitchell talks about tiny homes. Stay tuned. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. One way many people are choosing to lower their carbon footprint is by living in smaller houses, much smaller houses. So-called tiny houses range from about 100 to 400 square feet, and they're taking off as an option for those who want to live light on the land and on the budget. In his new book, Tiny House Living, Ryan Mitchell shows how living small can mean living well. The book explores the philosophy and design principles behind tiny houses and showcases some beautiful homes built by folks who live the simple life mortgage-free. Ryan Mitchell lives in the tiny house he built. Ryan Mitchell, welcome to Writer's Voice. I love this book, Tiny House Living, Ideas for Building and Living Well in Less Than 400 Square Feet. Now, that might seem like an impossibly tiny space for people to live in, and yet more and more people are living in spaces this small. Tell us about the tiny house movement and what's behind it.
So the tiny house movement is, it's frankly a growing movement, and every time I think it can't go any bigger, it grows even more. And a lot of people are attracted to it for a variety of reasons. It could be simple living, it could be eco-friendly green living. A lot of people want to live debt-free and kind of, you know, live life on their terms. And so, it's a wide appeal to a large group of folks. And it mainly centers on, houses between, 1 and 400 square feet, typically built on a trailer. And folks that do it are, come from all walks of life, and it's just kind of grown in its appeal over the past couple of years.
And how did you get into it?
So back in 2008, right before the Great Recession, I was just out of my master's program. I had landed that first career job, and it was going really well. 6 months into it, I was making lots of money. I enjoyed the work. And then one day, our boss came into the office and let us know that the whole company was folding. And we found ourselves standing on the sidewalk with our desks in a box and wondering, what's next? What are we going to do? I have rent next month. We knew that the economy was going down. It wasn't a great situation to be looking for work at the time. And so luckily I was able to find a job pretty quickly after that. But that feeling of not knowing how I was going to pay rent, how I was going to meet my bills, how I was just going to live, really, hit home for me. And I knew I never wanted to be in that position again. So I looked at my budget, and I noticed that about half of my income was going to housing. And I said, okay, crazy question. How could I completely eliminate that line item? Because I knew if I could eliminate that, I would effectively save myself half of my expenditures each month, which, in a way it would almost feel like doubling my income. And I knew that by having a stable place always to live, I didn't have to worry about that. And then the additional money that I could save could help me through rainy days and things like that. So I had no idea how I was going to do that. But I went out and I started searching and looking at options. And eventually I came to tiny houses, and I realized that for about the cost of 1 to 2 years rent, I could own a home completely myself, free and clear, and I would never have to worry about that half of my budget every month. It would just completely open up, huge potentials for my life and how I want to lead it, and just, security and comfort in my life. And so that's kind of how I found tiny houses. At the time, there really wasn't a whole lot. It was a very new concept back in 2007. It really kicked off. So 2008, it was really just getting its feet, at the very beginning. And that's when I, launched my blog, thetinylife.com, and kind of started cataloging my journey, and the rest is history.
And so tell us about your tiny home.
So my tiny house is 150 square feet. It also has a sleeping loft, which I don't include in that 150 square feet because it's only about 4.5 feet tall. in that loft there. So it's really only good for sleeping. But I have a queen bed up there. In the bottom floor is kind of divided into two halves. The front half is what we affectionately call the great room, which is kind of funny being in such a small space, but we call it the great room because it goes floor to ceiling. It has a huge, you know, I think it's 11.5 foot tall ceilings there. So it just feels like a really open space. There's lots of windows, and that's mainly the area that you live in. You'll eat there. I work out of that space as well when I'm doing work. And then the back half of it is divided into two. On the left is a full bathroom, so toilet, sink, shower, all that kind of stuff. And then I have a small kitchen on the right side, which, you know, has pretty much everything a normal kitchen has, just in a very compact space.
So you and the others that you feature in this book, and I have to say you feature some really beautiful homes in this book, tiny homes. You live in a very small space. You had to downsize. Everybody you talked to had to downsize. Talk about that process of getting to the point where you could fit your possessions into 150 square feet.
Yeah, it's certainly a big departure from kind of normal culture where, you know, in America, it's buy. It's, you know, we're continuously consuming it and adding things to our home, things like that. So it's a big shift from how most people live to a tiny house living. But that process is kind of twofold. The first is obviously thinning through your possessions and, you know, getting the things that you don't use every day or just general clutter out of your space and only focusing on things that you really use every day or that have really strong significance to you, you know, sentimentally wise. The second part is a psychological and behavioral aspect to it where, you know, we've been in a way conditioned from a very young age to buy a lot of things that we are almost, our worth is almost derived from the possessions that we have and how much we consume. And the tiny house movement tries to take a step back from that. You know, it's not that we reject necessarily consumption or purchasing things, but it's with a lot more intentionality and at typically a lot lower level. So, you know, like I said, from that young age, we're really used to just buying and consuming and disposing of things. And just we have huge homes so we can fill with a bunch of clutter. So psychologically, we really need to break ourselves from that because that's a habit that's been instilled from us from almost birth up until our adulthood where we've made this decision to live in a tiny house. So psychologically, you just have to understand why you consume things, why you want to purchase that thing. It means changing your behaviors. So if you see something in the store that you'd like to have, it may mean saying, okay, I'll think about it and I'll come back. And if I want it, you know, in 2 weeks from now, then maybe I'll consider buying it. But it's funny, you'll do that kind of exercise and you'll see it on the shelf or something 2 weeks later. You're like, eh, maybe I don't need that. And so you kind of self-edit that way. And one of the things that a lot of folks do with tiny houses is once they get their material possessions down to a smaller size, is they say, if I want to buy this thing, like a piece of clothing, if I'm going to bring that into my home, what is the one thing I'm going to take out of the home? So if I buy this new shirt, what's the one shirt that I should probably, you know, donate? Or if it's too well-worn, I just trash. But that one-for-one exchange is another technique that folks use when paring down their material possessions.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ryan Mitchell about tiny houses. His book is Tiny House Living, Ideas for Building and Living Well in Less Than 400 Square Feet. I have a question kind of about this process because it's very attractive, the idea of paring things down to the bare essentials. But what do you do about those things that you don't use every day, but sometimes you need? You don't want to have to go out and buy them again.
Yeah, so you just have to look at your possessions and consider, you know, like instances like that. Is this something that I could really do without, or even though I only use it every now and then, it's really suited best for the job, and there isn't a good replacement for it. So in that case, what we would do is we look at, first off, is there something that I already have that could perform that same function? So, you know, instead of a, an ottoman. So an ottoman, a lot of times they have extra storage in it. So if you're looking at like a storage bin, they go, oh, well, but I already have an ottoman. If you could instead have an ottoman that has a storage bin within it, then you kind of met both needs there. So that would be one thing, you know, find those multi-purpose items that you could use to replace the function of whatever that thing is. The next thing is, you know, potentially considering, you know, is it something that my family member already has, or my neighbor or something that they would be happy with just letting me borrow? If it's like, you know, a ladder is a really good example. You don't use a step ladder that often, but when you need it to reach something high, you kind of need it. But pretty much everyone has one in a traditional home, so it wouldn't be that much of a stretch to go over to your neighbor and say, hey, can I borrow your ladder? And you know, maybe you help them out with something later on and just be good neighbors that way. So we look at things if we could borrow those things. And then finally, if you know none of those things are going to work, we look at maybe some small space alternatives to that item. So a good example is I just bought a colander for my house to replace my other colander, because my old colander was pretty big, and I recently found one that collapses in on itself, so it takes about a third of the space of the original colander. So those are some of the things that we can look at for alternatives to having those one-off items. And we try to have things that, again, we use most of the time, and we want to stay away from kind of those one-off instances that we use in a once a blue moon.
Now, you mentioned going over to a neighbor's. You, Ryan Mitchell, you have an example in your book, Tiny House Living, of a tiny house community. Now, that might be another way for people to share items that they don't use all that often but don't want to live without.
As tiny houses kind of grow, there's just a natural tendency that for people to want to connect with and live in close proximity to folks that do also kind of participate in the tiny house lifestyle. So it would be actually an interesting experiment to see having like a communal thing where you have those one-off things like a ladder or whatever the case may be, that the community kind of, everyone just pitched in their share of it and they bought it one for the whole set, and they could have a little shed or something where they could keep that. And then I also know there's websites now that kind of facilitate this trading within a community, where you can, you know, someone has a tool, you can hop on a website, find that person, and then, you know, they lend it to you and with the hopes that you'll someday help someone else or help them down the road. So this kind of communal trading is definitely an interesting subtopic of tiny living.
So you mentioned before that most of these tiny houses are on trailers. Why is that?
It's twofold, really. The first one is to help with building codes and zoning. Tiny houses are so small that they typically don't meet minimum building requirements because of their square footage. And it's not that they can't be done safely or, you know, with proper building techniques. It's mainly because municipalities need to be able to guarantee a certain taxation rate. If you say the minimum square footage of every home in our county is going to be X number of square feet, then you know that you can count on a minimum of that taxation to do what governments do. So, you know, tiny houses run into this issue of not meeting that minimum square requirement, even though they're built to every other code and safety expectation, things like that. So when you put it on a trailer, it enters it into a legal gray zone where, you know, governments don't really know how to classify it. They don't really know what to do with it. Is it a trailer or is it a house? You know, with a trailer, well, that's the DMV or the DOT. But if it's a house, well, that's the city and building inspectors. And so it helps bring some uncertainty for the bureaucracies because they like to fit everything in really neat boxes and kind of define them. And then they can, once they get you in that box, they can legislate and control the path from there. But when you make it difficult to be categorized, it opens up more conversations so you can be more flexible with things when you're working with your county. The other reason is, you know, it's flexible housing. You don't have to always be in one fixed location. And this is, I think, relevant to our time where a lot of people change jobs with somewhat, you know, regular frequency, unfortunately, because layoffs or, you know, shifts in the markets and companies closing and opening and things like that. So you may be on the East Coast having a great job, you work there for 5 years, and then, you know, you go on to a better opportunity on the West Coast. Well, all you have to do is hook up your house and, you know, make the journey, and it can be a pretty simple affair versus trying to sell a house, and if the market's down, you just got to carry that house, and then, you know, trying to decide if you want to carry two mortgages and then buy a place over there, or are you going to rent over there. It just simplifies the whole process if you need to move in your life. So I think it helps with the building codes, and it also helps with flexibility in your life there.
Now, do you live alone in your house?
I do.
But not everybody does. So what can people do who want to build, you say, in less than 400 square feet? I used to live in, I lived in an apartment for 6 years that was about 350 square feet, and I found that pretty comfortable. So I can imagine less than 400, but 400 is hard to put on a trailer, isn't it?
It's about the maximum you can put on a trailer. Typically, up to 350 is pretty comfortable on a trailer. 400 is certainly pushing it. But what I tell folks is, and they always get bogged down in the number, how many square feet is a tiny house. And what I like to say is, it really doesn't matter about the square footage. What matters is that the space that you're living in, the space that you've designed and built, suits your life. And if that means your life has a partner in the mix, that means that it's suited for you and your partner's life to basically reach the goals that you have set in your own life. So as long as it's meeting your needs, as long as it's facilitating reaching your goals, it really shouldn't matter so much about the square footage. And I would make the argument that you should do that in the most efficient square footage possible, which I think a lot of people would be surprised when you step into a tiny house. Even though it's 150 square feet, it's so well designed and laid out that people, every single time I have someone step into a tiny house, and they always comment how much bigger it feels. And I think that kind of speaks to how poorly designed housing is designed today, especially newer construction within the past 20 years. It's just really poorly laid out and not well thought out, and it's maximized for profits, not for supporting the person that's living in it. And they design them for the largest kind of demographic. They don't design for the individual because people are so worried about resale potential and value that they can't. So there's lots of couples that live in 150 square feet together, and they've been doing it for years. I know one couple, and they're actually featured in the book, Tiny House Living, where they not only live in it, but they also work full-time in their tiny house. So it's certainly possible, but it just has to be the right size for you.
And we are talking with Ryan Mitchell. He's the author of Tiny House Living, Ideas for Building and Living Well in Less Than 400 Square Feet. So you mentioned the word design, and it seems to me that that's really the critical one. What are some of the design principles that you could share with our audience that could help them live in such a small space and yet feel comfortable?
Sure. The first one is what we call subtractive design. Basically, it's where you develop a design, and you look at it and its components and things like that, where things are laid out and what's included, and you start to, you know, theoretically remove certain elements. Say, if I were to take out this sink in the bathroom, would that impact the design in a positive way or in a negative way? you'd be surprised at how often removing a certain element or whatever is actually a positive for the design, because there's a lot of duplication within houses. And one of the things that larger houses kind of get caught up in is hallways. If you think about it, a hallway is a relatively large space that you use maybe 5 minutes a day if you're walking a lot in your house. But other than that, it's just completely empty space that you aren't residing and living in, storing in, and you have to heat and cool that space, maintain it, things like that. So we look at ways to remove spaces that aren't used a lot. You know, there's certain areas that, like the bathroom, for example, you know, you don't use a bathroom, but maybe, let's say, an hour a day or so, but there's no real way to just eliminate it completely because it takes up a good amount of space. I think my bathroom is about 6 feet by 4 feet wide. So, you know, that's a good amount of square footage to give up for something that I'm only using in about an hour a day. But I can't really take it out completely. But what I can do is say, hey, I have a sink right outside the door of the bathroom that I could use to wash my hands. And so I can remove that sink from the bathroom that you normally find. I can reduce that square footage that I'm using for the bathroom by another 2 or 4 square feet. And therefore, I'm being more efficient with that design. So that's the basics to subtractive design. The other thing I would say is, you know, design the space for what your activities are in life, and you want to basically design it for the needs. And one of the things I talk about in Tiny House Living is looking at, you know, what exactly are the functions that a house provides for you personally. And it's going to be different for everyone. Obviously, it's a place to sleep and it's a place to store things. But, you know, if you're a sewer, you need a place to sew. If you work from home, you need an office. But those are going to be different for every person. So you want to look at the space that you're currently in, see what functions it provides you, and then kind of design your tiny house to meet those functions.
You say that people often come into a house and they're surprised to find it's larger than they expected. What are some of the ways that people can design their house to give it a larger sense of spaciousness?
A couple ways that I typically try to do is, in a tiny house, there's usually quite a few windows. And if I think the average American home has about 29 windows, and it's about 2,400 square feet or so. We compare that to a tiny house. My house is 150 square feet. I have 12 windows in my house. So, the ratio of square footage to windows is a lot higher. So we use that to bring in exterior natural lighting. And also, one thing that we're very intentional about is placing windows where commonly your eye is going to be. So a good example is when you first walk in the door, a great place to put a window is in the opposite wall, so that when you walk straight in, you're looking basically out a window. And psychologically, what you're doing is you're extending your sight line. Even though it's in a small space, you're extending it beyond the far wall out into the world, and it almost seems endless at that point because you have that window to kind of extend that sight line. The other thing is, obviously, you want to do, you know, lighter kind of materiality, color choices and things like that. Some folks also like to do a dark floor as a contrast to kind of a lighter, you know, wall. A lot of tiny houses use interior wood paneling to kind of bring out the brighter upper part. And then I think just strategically designing all your storage and things so that you can't really see it. One of the things about larger homes is we kind of tuck clutter away, but we also have a lot of clutter around, especially on desks and things like that. And when you live in a tiny house, you can't just have clutter around because it's just too small space. It's just going to drive you nuts. So you can't just throw your jeans on the floor or have stacks of paper on your desk or leave the dishes, you know, just piling up because it's just too small of a space to really be able to have that kind of behavior going on. So you quickly adjust things so that, You know, the clutter is always taken care of. The dishes are always done. The clothes are always put away and things like that. So a tiny house just forces you to be more cognizant of those types of clutter that can kind of make a space feel small.
So have you had any moments when you felt like, oh, I really need more space than this?
I think the only time I felt like that was, you know, I built my own tiny house myself. And in that process, I needed a good number of tools to actually do that. I'm not a builder, you know, professionally or anything. And I had quite a few tools just to build a house. I mean, it's essentially a regular house with all the same techniques and everything, but on a smaller scale. And so I had quite a few tools, you know, after my house was built that I kind of had to come to terms with. It's like, well, what do I want to do with these? And what I realized during the building process was that I really enjoyed woodworking, and that it was something that I wanted to continue. So I ended up getting a space where I could do woodworking, and that's where I put my tools. But, you know, beyond that, if I really examine, you know, there's a situation where that arise, where I felt like I needed more space for something or my stuff or whatever the case may be, you know, I would just examine that. And if that is what the demands of my life and where I wanted to go, you know, dictated, then I could do that. You know, like I said, it's not so much about the square footage. It's about designing a home that suits the occupant and the life and their goals. And as long as you're intentional about that, you know, you can't be faulted for, you know, having a 400 square foot tiny house versus a 150 square foot. As long as you're very intentional about how you go about it is the really important part.
Well, it's a terrific book, and the houses portrayed in it are really beautiful. I want to thank you so much, Ryan Mitchell, for sharing your book, Tiny House Living and the Tiny House Lifestyle, with us on here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I looked at my budget, and I noticed that about half of my income was going to housing. And I said, okay, crazy question. How could I completely eliminate that line item? So I had no idea how I was going to do that. But I went out and I started searching, and eventually I came to tiny houses, and I realized that for about the cost of 1 to 2 years rent, I could own a home free and clear.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ryan Mitchell about tiny houses. His book is Tiny House Living, Ideas for Building and Living Well in Less Than 400 Square Feet. Ryan Mitchell's blog is The Tiny Life, and he's co-host of the podcast Tiny House Chat. Go to writersvoice.net for images of some of the tiny houses in Ryan Mitchell's book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.